Today's macroeconomic policy news is brought to you by the letters E, C, and B. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday today, July the 2nd. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Central bank aficionados out there will already know this, but there were big doings today in Brussels. Christine Lagarde, for the past 8 years, the head of the International Monetary Fund, has been named to run the European Central Bank, the aforementioned ECB. Think of it as the European Union's Federal Reserve, except with 19 different economies whose interests you got to juggle. It's a big deal for Europe and for the rest of us, this being a global economy as it is. So we have called Martina Stavis-Gurdeneff. She covers the EU for the New York Times. We got her in Brussels. Welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
It's safe to say that Madame Lagarde got this job after a marathon negotiating session. How did they land on her, do you suppose?
Well, you know, it's funny. I used to cover Brussels 5 years ago, and every time a major position came up, someone would say, "What about Christine Lagarde?"
That's right.
And so I suppose this time she said yes.
She brings to the job qualifications that are not customary for a central banker, right? She's been on the global stage. She's a lawyer by training, not an economist. And yet now she will be doing certainly some political back and forth, but also monetary policy.
That's right. I mean, I think obviously the attractiveness is that she is a truly tested coalition builder. She has agility, she has grace, and she's a tough cookie. And so I think she'll need all of those skills and attributes in this new role. She certainly brings a lot of glamour and profile to a role that was previously, like, frankly, somewhat gray, not to underestimate Mario Draghi's sort of sardonic sense of humor, but still.
Right. No, that's a point well taken. She does, though, take this job at a time when the global economy is slowing, difficult decisions might need to be made. There is some peril, some unsavory aspects of this for her.
No, absolutely. And I think her Eurozone crisis experience, remember, the IMF was heavily involved in the bailouts for the Eurozone countries that were in trouble, in particular Greece. She worked very closely with the European Central Bank and the European Commission during that time. You know, that experience is going to be invaluable. Italy is in hot water over the management of its own books and fiscal management. And you can certainly see how her role as a sort of top multilateral lender policymaker, that's a mouthful, sorry for that, is going to hold her in good stead in these times, in particular with a possibility of a global downturn. And through her role at the International Monetary Fund, especially at the at the back of the global financial crisis as well, she's really dealt with that.
It has to be pointed out here that Christine Lagarde was, I'm pretty sure this is right, the only woman at the global level when it came to economic policy discussions as the head of the IMF, right? There used to be Janet Yellen and Christine Lagarde, and now, of course, they both are no longer in those positions. But as you pointed out today, she is becoming a key European policymaker. Also, Jean-Claude Juncker, the head of the European Commission president, is being replaced by Ursula von der Leyen, a German woman. That's a big step.
It is. It's a very big and it's a very interesting step. Ursula von der Leyen's background and her curriculum vitae, as it were, makes for really interesting reading. But she's also had, she's a physician by training. She's a mother of seven. So she's clearly a very good multitasker and manager, which will be very useful here in the Commission, in particular as the Commission goes into managing Brexit and really heading a bureaucracy of 32,000 staff. I mean, imagine that.
A handful, to be sure. Martina Stavis-Gurdeneff, she covers the European Union for the New York Times out of Brussels. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
We had, I should point out here, Christine Lagarde on the program back in February talking about the global economy and her friend, Janet Yellen. You can hear that interview at marketplace.org. On Wall Street this Tuesday, a little bit choppy, ended pretty close to unchanged. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've reported often on this program about the market forces that are driving American coal to the sidelines of our energy economy. The latest entry comes from the Powder River Basin in Montana and Wyoming, the biggest, most productive, and most efficient, that is, cheapest place to mine coal in the United States. For all those business advantages, though, last night brought bankruptcy nonetheless. Normally, bankruptcy means reorganizing while the digging continues, but not this time. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong explains.
More than 600 miners in rural Wyoming are now unemployed. That's more than 10% of the mining jobs in the entire state. The mining company Black Jewel closed down the fourth and sixth largest mines in the country. Early yesterday, the company talked of reorganizing and staying afloat. But then, bank money fell through.
Yesterday was kind of like a heart attack in the Powder River Basin.
Robert Godby is an energy economist at the University of Wyoming.
It was kind of a out-of-the-blue outcome. People woke up that morning thinking they had a job, and by the end of the day, they didn't.
It's the most dramatic of five bankruptcies in 4 years in the Powder River Basin, or PRB. Coal is cheap and abundant there, but even the PRB can't compete with cheaper natural gas. Gas electricity plants are multiplying, and coal plants are shutting down, says Bloomberg Intelligence analyst Andrew Cosgrove.
People underestimated the power plants that were going to close down. I think that most people had thought that PRB coal wouldn't be impacted as much.
Coal production in the West is down 35% the past decade. John Morgan at Respec Consulting sees a long-term decline despite efforts by the Trump administration to loosen coal plant pollution rules.
The pricing of gas is probably driving it more than anything else, and any small change in policy on plant emissions might stay the execution of some plants, but it's not going to change the overall landscape.
In Wyoming, one question for the Black Jewel mines is, assuming they stay closed, who pays for environmental cleanup? Again, economist Rob Godby.
If Black Jewel goes bankrupt and there are, you know, goes through, for example, a Chapter 7, there's a very high probability that the state and the federal government could be left holding the bag on the cleanup.
He's already watching for the next mining shutdown. Another bankrupt firm plans to auction its assets next week. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Should you somehow have needed more evidence that politics and business can be an explosive mix, we bring you now the story of Nike and the state of Arizona. Nike, as you might have heard, has pulled a 4th of July-themed sneaker with a Betsy Ross flag on the heel. It's a symbol that's been co-opted by far-right groups, and Nike reportedly got pushback on it as well from Colin Kaepernick and others. In return, Governor Doug Ducey of Arizona announced he is pulling state subsidies for a factory that Nike had promised to build in Goodyear, just outside Phoenix. Nike is just one big company, though, that Goodyear has managed to attract over the past couple of years. Marketplace's Jack Stewart looked at how the city did it and what the current dust-up might mean for him.
Just last night, Goodyear City Council approved $2 million in subsidies to bring a Nike manufacturing plant to the city. Laurie Gary, its economic development director, spoke at the meeting.
After a long and extensive search, Nike IMH Inc. chose Goodyear, Arizona.
There's a long history of businesses getting subsidies to move to locations that want to attract jobs. And there's also a history of political tension around those decisions, says Joseph Minerick at the Committee for Economic Development.
There's always a sense that the businesses are holding the towns or states to ransom.
This time, Governor Ducey is trying to do the reverse, but it's not clear whether he can impact the incentives that Goodyear promised to Nike. The city didn't make anyone available for comment. Money isn't the only incentive that Goodyear has to offer. Reporter Joshua Bowling at the Arizona Republic says it has a foreign trade zone, which offers companies, including UPS, Dick's Sporting Goods, REI, and Chewy.com, breaks on import and export taxes.
The foreign trade zone idea was kind of unique for Arizona. City officials really pointed to that as being responsible for drawing in big tenants like Dick's Sporting Goods.
Nike hasn't said whether it'll change its plans, but Matt Powell, sneakerologist at market research firm NPD Group, says this spat won't hurt the brand's sales. In fact, quite the opposite.
The consumer is really demanding that brands and retailers take visible and vocal stands on social issues.
And for some context, that $2 million in incentives that Goodyear offered, well, Nike earns that in half an hour. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
We'll be right back. There is, and I'm pretty sure I've never said these words on this program before, but there is big sushi news today. The London-based chain Yo! Sushi says it's going to buy one of the biggest operators of sushi kiosks here in the United States, Houston-based Snow Fox by name. I should tell you that Yo! It actually has the exclamation point in the name. Anyway, something near $100 million is the price for a stake in Snow Fox, which runs about 700 mini sushi joints, mostly in grocery stores. It's the latest indicator that the market for prepared foods in grocery stores is hot. The American grocery store is the new mall food court, if you will, as Marketplace's Renata Sago reports.
The Fresco y Mas supermarket in Southeast Orlando sells your standard grocery items. But Shannon Velez is here today for the hot empanadas. She's carrying two big bags of them from the prepared food section. This is her second time here.
I did get the empanada before. I just happened to be passing here today, so I decided to come in.
It's not just that grocery stores are selling more prepared food. They're bringing in restaurants, like sushi kiosks. Whole Foods partners with the vegan burger chain called Next Level Burger. The Midwest grocer Hy-Vee has opened Wahlburgers restaurants in its stores. Tori Gundelach is with Kantar Consulting. She says grocery stores are embracing this trend to compete for busy consumers, the kind who are ordering from delivery services like Grubhub.
When you add on food away from home to the food at home business, it almost doubles the total size of the market that a grocer is playing in. So the size of prize gets much bigger.
She says adding new prepared food options is also a win for grocers in another way.
That can really show that the grocer is on the forefront of food trends.
Rick Stein at the Food Marketing Institute expects the prepared food market to rake in big, big bucks as more and more grocers become what the industry now calls grocerants.
Where they combine the grocery store with the restaurant. You even see sit-down areas and, you know, the fireplace, the ambiance, the whole bit of a restaurant.
Take Kroger's. The chain announced it's planning to open a 45,000-square-foot store in downtown Cincinnati this fall. It'll have five restaurants inside, including a barbecue joint and an Asian street food spot. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
Coming up,
you see 5 shares, 25 shares, 1,000 shares, 1 share.
Things can move fast after hours, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 69 points today, about 0.25%, closed at 26,786. The NASDAQ up 17 points, 0.2%, 8,109 there. The S&P 500 up 8 points, 0.3%, 29.73. Talked at the top of the program about the controversy surrounding Nike today. Shares down about 0.5%. Oil prices were dragged down by yesterday's data showing signs of a slowdown in manufacturing here and in Europe. That caused big oil companies to decline as well. Exxon down 1.1%. Chevron down about 1.5%. Delta Airlines says demand for air travel is going to be closer to the high end of its previous estimate for the quarter. That sent shares up 1.3% today. Bond prices rose as well. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note, get a load of this, 1.97%. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. And before we get you into this next story, there is something I need you to hear. Also, this. ¶¶ That first bit, perhaps you could tell, is the opening notes of Led Zeppelin's classic Stairway to Heaven, released in 1971. The second bit is from a song called Taurus, released by the band Spirit in 1968. Pretty similar, right? Here's Stairway to Heaven one more time. And Taurus. Those two songs are at issue in an unresolved copyright lawsuit, but there is something else you need to know about that, because for music that old, pre-1978, what the song looks like when it's written out on sheet music might turn out to be more important for copyright protection than what it sounds like. Vernon Silva wrote about this from Bloomberg. Thanks for coming in.
All right, thanks.
Tell me how you came upon this story.
It started about 5 years ago when I saw on YouTube that the Stairway to Heaven introduction sounded a lot like a song by the band Spirit, this obscure instrumental. Yeah. And so, you know, has nothing been done about this? And did a first story where we kind of made the comparisons and looked into Led Zeppelin's alleged plagiarism. Mm-hmm. And that led to a lawsuit in federal court and a trial in L.A.
And there you are in court one day, and?
And things are not going really well for the lawyer for Spirit, because they're getting pummeled on what seems to be a technicality, which is the sheet music that was deposited in the copyright office in Washington was literally half a page. And he had to say, you infringed on these 124 notes right. that sound yeah. nothing like what's on the record.
So I need to back you up here yeah. and dig in a little bit on this thing that's on deposit, this thing called the deposit copy. How does music copyright work for songs this old, right? This is pre-1978. Right.
So before 1978, what you had to do to register a musical composition was deposit some sheet music. In the case of once we got into the rock and roll era, that meant that a band would make a record and it was handed to a scribe at the record company who then, right. you know, with a pencil, did some sheet music and they registered that with the copyright office.
They literally put it on deposit.
Yeah.
Got it. And so the discrepancy that gets discovered in this trial is what exactly?
Well, this lawyer for Spirit is having a really hard time, and so he pulls out the Stairway to Heaven deposit copy, and he's got Jimmy Page, the guitarist from Led Zeppelin, yeah. who played the famous solo and all this other stuff, and hands up and says, can you see on these four pages of this deposit copy that you deposited your guitar solo, which is your crowning achievement? And page after page, like, no, it's not there. At this moment in the trial, it became pretty clear to me as somebody sitting there, like, holy cow, is it possible that all of the greatest solos of jazz, rock, the saxophones, the guitars were never registered compositions?
That is to say, stuff that's improvisationally riffed, one imagines, right? Because yes. it's not written down anywhere.
Right.
In essence, it doesn't count.
And also stuff that's really hard for the scribe at the record company at the time right. to have put into notation.
And then what happens?
And then Led Zeppelin won, which was perfectly good for Jimmy Page.
Yeah.
And then there was an appeal, and each side appealed other stuff. And the one issue that became a sticking point was whether or not what was on the deposit copy in this really skimpy sheet music was the only thing that was protected.
Give me some other examples. I mean, in this article, you run through a bunch of them.
Right. So this is what got me curious is, could there be other? Was it just Stairway to Heaven?
Right.
No, it's not just Stairway to Heaven. If you look at Let's Get It On, the Marvin Gaye song... Yeah. The deposit copy is melody, lyrics, and a chord progression. You could, if you stuck to the how the law is completely strictly, you could re-record everything on that Marvin Gaye record, essentially make a perfect karaoke yeah. track, and it could be yours.
Put on your entrepreneurial business person's hat. You could make a ringtone out of some of these. You could, I don't even know what you could do.
You can do ads. You can right. do ringtones. You can score a movie. You can make a whole new composition. And this was sort of the experiment we did.
Well, that's you're getting
yeah.
the kicker
was,
of the piece.
At that moment in the courtroom was kind of like seeing that somebody had dropped a bunch of $100 bills and I had to pick yeah. them up for safekeeping. And the idea was that we would make a song maybe called Purple Hotel Stairway to, you know, Purple Haze,
right,
all these
right,
other
right.
ones, Sympathy for the Devil. Some of them didn't check out. We were left with free hotel riders on the stairway to run, which was a mashup of Doris Springsteen, you name it.
Now what happens? I mean, where's this going to go? It's in court, and then...
It's sort of doubly in court now. So there is a separate case in New York involving Marvin Gaye's Let's Get It On and Ed Sheeran. And that one, there's a hearing in the coming weeks where they're going to figure out whether they're going to put that trial on hold pending what happens in the Zeppelin case. Because now, in an extraordinary move, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco has agreed to rehear the appeal in the Stairway to Heaven case. And so far, the only issue they've asked for briefs about is the deposit copy.
Vernon Silver writes for Bloomberg, this time about music. Vernon, thanks a lot. Appreciate
your
time.
Thank you.
This is going to be a short week on Wall Street. Markets close early Wednesday, then they are closed entirely on Thursday for the 4th of July. And when I say entirely, that means the after-hours sessions as well. Of course, the trading that gets done between the opening bell and the closing bell gets all the glory. But as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, after hours matters too.
You can't sit down at a restaurant after it's closed for the day. You can't buy carrots at the farmer's market after the vendors go home. But when stock markets close at 4 p.m. Eastern, the trading continues.
Shares of PPG are soaring in after-hours trading.
On the after-hours, Oracle's up 5% plus or minus.
We've got an earnings alert on AT&T. It's falling in the after-hours session. Let's get to Julia Borsman.
After-hours trading lasts 4 hours till 8 p.m. Eastern. Companies often release news then, and investors can trade on it without waiting for exchanges to turn the lights back on. Last week, Apple announced its chief design officer is leaving and shares dropped by 1% after the bell, erasing nearly $9 billion of the company's value. Pull up the NASDAQ website and you can even watch after-hours trades roll in.
You see 5 shares, 25 shares, 1,000 shares, 1 share, 137 shares.
That's Georgetown finance professor James Angel. We're talking on Skype at about 5 Eastern on a Monday evening. Markets have been closed for an hour and we're watching Facebook shares. Angel says those small trades are probably retail investors, but then two huge trades come in for 300,000 Facebook shares apiece. We can't tell who made those trades, but given their size, Angel has a hunch.
Probably an institutional trade, probably a mutual fund or a pension fund. And somebody was eager to get that trade done today.
It used to be a lot harder to trade once markets closed. Then, in the 80s, a brokerage called Instanet launched an electronic exchange that let big institutions trade with each other in the evening, like mutual funds and pension funds. By the late 1990s, trading platforms like E-Trade came along and reduced barriers for regular folks, too. Now, says Angel,
anybody can trade after hours. The reality is, very few people do.
The real action is still during the normal trading day. When Angel and I were watching Facebook stock, investors traded 15 million shares when markets were open. After hours, just a few hundred thousand shares moved around. Hillary Kramer at Kramer Capital Research says there might have been more trading if Facebook had announced something big after the closing bell.
Maybe there's lawsuits pending in other countries. Maybe there's actually a slowdown in subscriber user growth.
Researchers have studied this and found that managers strategically use the after-hours session to release bad news, since most traders aren't paying attention. In fact, a lot of managers wait till Friday night to announce this stuff. Researchers also found that when bad news comes out during the late session, stocks don't drop by as much as they normally would. Kramer says she uses the after-hours market to get a jump start on trading, but it can be risky for amateurs.
It's something not to be fooled around with. There's a lot of money to be lost by going extended hours versus standard market hours.
Plus, the fact that so few people are trading in the after-hours session means that markets can swing around by a lot. When that happens, Karen Cavanaugh at Voya Investment Management starts getting phone calls.
Saying, what should we do? How should we play this? Should we get in the market? Should we get out of the market?
Cavanaugh basically advises investment advisors who have clients on the other line. She says clients tend to act impulsively when they see big market movements on their phones or on business shows like CNBC.
Very often, investors will make a contradictory decision, a knee-jerk reaction that is to the detriment of their portfolio.
And they might wake up the next day to find that everything has changed. along with a balance of their investment accounts. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out, in which there is a market for everything, however briefly. Those Nike Betsy Ross sneakers that Jack Stewart was telling us about, the sneaker website StockX had them for a bit this morning at a premium after the news broke that Nike was pulling them. Listed at $120, available for $2,500 a pair until the site took them down. Said the StockX CEO, quote, "The sale of this product on our platform does not align with our value system," end of quote. All right, we are leaving. Today, the Dow Industrial is up 69 points, about 0.25%. The NASDAQ up 17 points, that is 0.2%. The S&P 500 up 8 points, about 0.3%. Our digital and on-demand team includes Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Brian Ronahan, Arjuna Soriano, and Tony Wagner. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.